Jim Lundy. I would like to start just by reading the definition of depression that, or the statement about it that's at the top of the handout to get us started, because I suppose if there's two things I would like to get across about depression for people who suffer from it, it's that it's multi-causal. There's no one factor that causes depression, and that most people with a serious enough depression to say that they suffer from it have more than one reason or cause behind that depression. And the other thing is that for folks who suffer from depression for a 1, 2, or 3 year period, which is often how long, 1/10 to 1/5 of the population suffers from severe depression in America. It's as tough as having cancer. And that might sound like a big analogy, but when you see folks who have suffered long term with just this intense sense of blueness and hopelessness, and there's no future for me, you get a sense of how it has worn them down and how it can really wear family members down. And how if you have a cancer or diabetes or some other illness or disease that we're a little more comfortable with in our culture, you get sometimes more support. But we often see the families of someone who's chronically and severely depressed suffer alone after several months, because we don't know how to support those people. Most of us have visited someone in the hospital who's had surgery or a baby for, you know, a positive reason to go to the hospital or some other problem. Much less do we visit people in mental hospitals or psychiatric units. And when we do, we aren't as comfortable there. So let's just start with this idea that depression is a cluster of symptoms which can be related to or caused by several very different factors, including stress, genetic tendencies, hormones, unresolved grief, and we'll even build a larger list before the hour's over today. It's very important not to see depression as one type of a problem, but to assess each individual's depression for its unique combination of contributing factors. Depression is the most universal of emotional problems, but it has very diverse causes. And so most people who are in the midst of a relationship problem, or a severe physical illness, or a lot of life changes, or whatever, have depression in addition to all of the other things going on. So it's very, very common. For sure, in a group like ours today, there's some of us who have suffered seriously with depression, and you could tell that story very well, and even better than I am, some of these issues. So that's what we want to talk about. Now, for those of you who have seen this model, just bear with me again, but this is one of the areas where this model is most important, to remember that a person's awareness is made up of thoughts and feelings. We've got this memorized by now. And that they interact with each other. But that outside of this human awareness, we have factors that flow into it and affect it that you can't automatically feel or know where the pain is coming from. So over here you have a biological factor. And let's stop now as we think about depression and talk our way through some of the causes that could come from here. What are some biological causes of depression?
Hormone imbalance.
Hormones?
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Certain drugs, the side effects are depression. I'm not
right.
Specifics, but
can anybody think of any specifics? You ever been on any medicine that the side effect was depression?
Valium.
Mm-hmm. Others?
Some of the beta blockers, Cordard, etc.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Somebody said something I didn't hear.
Alcohol.
Yeah, I was waiting for that. The common American drug. Alcohol. And that's why we have now what are called dual diagnosis treatment centers, but also for a person who's done a lot of drinking for a long time, you really can't tell if their depression comes from a depressive source separate from alcohol or alcohol until they've stopped drinking for 30, 60, or some people would say even 30, 60 days, or some people would say 6 months. And if you stop drinking and the depression lifts, it was related to the alcohol. But if it doesn't lift, then maybe there's another source. But clearly, alcohol would be the number one most commonly used drug in America that has a side effect of depression. Well, many things here. Hormones, PMS, other physical abnormalities, drugs, alcohol, all are under this. And this is where we want to remind ourselves that the brain is an organ. And that's so important for understanding depression, because we're real comfortable understanding cancer is attacking a lung or a liver. But it's very, very awkward for us to think of the brain as an organ. And I often think that Christians in particular think that the organs stop at the neck and everything above the neck is spiritual. And you can't see it. You can't, you know, and I hear people say this, you know, they say, well, my psychiatrist said I have a chemical imbalance. Who knows what that is? I asked him what it was. He couldn't explain it. He can't measure it. It's poppycock. He just wants me to take these drugs. But, you know, it's very important to understand that the brain is this electrochemical computer that communicates through electrochemical processes, and that those in fact change with chronic stress, with pressure, and also for some folks they come genetically, are inherited, and you have to live with the fact that you have two or three lines of generations of depressed people in your background, and that maybe that's going to impinge on you. Now, that's not something that you need to be panicked about at all. If you know there's a family line of depression that may include suicide, it shouldn't scare you about your kids any more than if you have a family line of alcoholism. It's really, this will sound funny, but if I had a family line of alcoholism, which I don't particularly, but to my knowledge, I wouldn't see that as bad news. I would just see it as a time to sit down with my kids at about 16 and say, you know, biologically, you're not a good candidate to process ethyl alcohol. What it's going to do in your body is metabolize different than the kid sitting next to you in class, and you're going to be likely to get addicted to it. Therefore, in our family, we have to take some caution. Just like if you had a family of diabetics, you would say to your kids, well, you know, we have adult onset diabetes, and here's some things that you can maybe do to help yourself out. If you have a family line of depression, don't panic. It just means that you need to take a little better care of yourself. Another feature of understanding our brain as an organ is that as we age, it ages as well. And I know several psychiatrists who would say that as we age, our brain's efficiency and capabilities decline a bit, just like all of our other organs, and we're more susceptible to a depression as we approach 50, 60, that might be very responsive to medication, not so responsive to counseling. But if we really resist this idea that I'm mortal and that my brain's in order, we say, oh, you know, the last thing I ever want to take is an antidepressant. And so we suffer needlessly. And for me, that's very sad. And as a psychologist, someone who doesn't prescribe medicine, I'm probably very active compared to a lot of people in trying to get folks to see their brain as an organ and being willing to take an antidepressant when it's appropriate, because it can lead to fast recovery. It can alleviate all kinds of suffering and suffering that if we go the quote natural route of counseling only, it can take a year to get recovery down here when you could get it in 2 months with this. And I think human suffering is significant enough that we should alleviate it when we can. So under the biological, we need to remember that the brain is a true organ. And it has its own processes. Okay, let's look at spiritual. What are some spiritual causes of depression?
Guilt.
Guilt?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we say guilt over here, I would want to separate that from all-pervasive guilt. All-pervasive guilt, you maybe had that experience or had friends who had it, where everything I do is bad, I'm sinning all the time, I'm no good. That's not a very realistic picture of anybody, is it? I don't think so. We're talking here about real guilt, not irrational guilt, but real guilt. Would that fit with what you were saying?
Yeah.
Okay, what other spiritual causes of depression? Real guilt, meaning I violated consciously my own value system and beliefs about God and right living. That should produce depression.
Loneliness.
Mm-hmm. You want to amplify that a bit? That's sure.
That's easier. I'm up here. I'm an angel over here.
Go ahead.
Maybe being in the midst of people, but not being able to feel a bond with people. So, a sense of loneliness.
And maybe, since we're thinking of this as the spiritual area, a sense of being disconnected from God as well. And I think, as an aside, for people who do spiritual counseling, if I don't feel connected anymore to my family or my kids or my coworkers, and people are very descriptive, and they'll even say, I don't even feel connected to my dog. I don't even feel like I want to play with my, you know, little poodle or whatever. And then they also say, but I'm not connected to God. I think we use the same internal feeling process to connect to people and our pets as God. And I don't want to diminish God. I'm not trying to make a joke there. I think that if I am blind and emotionally and can't connect with people or the feeling world around me, I don't think I'm going to connect real well with God either, because I think it's the same feeling system that connects with Him. Okay, so we've got guilt and loneliness. What other spiritual sources of depression?
When your children leave home and you wonder what to do with the rest of your life, is for some people.
Yeah, and that's one I didn't know if we would get to, but that's certainly the biggest. And I say that in the sense of meaning. What's the meaning of my life? And some of us never have the luxury to get to that question, because you don't get to the question about what's the meaning of my life until you've taken care of, you know, do I have enough economic security and so on and so forth. And many of us, even in America with so much affluence, don't get to the meaning question. You might think we would, but as I listen to people, they're still scrapping and scraping because they keep raising what they need to have. And even well-to-do families with 40 and 50-year-old executive men aren't questioning the meaning of their life. They're questioning how they're going to pay for their second vacation or things like that. And I don't say that critically at all. I just say that getting to the question of meaning is not done often. But when we do it, it can be a great source of depression or exhilaration. But the meaning question is a spiritual question, absolutely. Good, any others? Here? Okay, then we come down to what we've called the psychological part of ourself, or our learning history. And these are all separate now. See, what's important is to realize that a person in here can be very depressed, and maybe they have an all-pervasive guilt instead of a real guilt, but we're a spiritual counselor, so we think their depression is from being guilty, when in fact, maybe they have a hormone imbalance. Or maybe they've been taking a medicine that has a side effect. Or maybe they're drinking and we don't know it. So it isn't the symptom that tells us where these are. It's a careful evaluation of your life. It's a very careful reflection and questioning in each one of these areas. Now, what are some psychological causes of depression?
Hidden anger.
Hidden anger. You want to amplify that? That's sure, right?
Well, I think you can house an anger within you that you're not really in touch with. And this then comes out sideways as a, well, for me as a child, I was never allowed to be angry. So all of this was stuffed and stuffed and stuffed. And then it came out as depression. And until that anger was resurfaced and dealt with, the depression was always there.
And those are key words, resurfaced and dealt with. For a while, there was a very popular therapy that you would know under the name of Gestalt therapy, which has the idea that if you get it out, it somehow leaves you, sort of like exorcism or vomiting. Then get enough of the anger out, and what happens when you do that, just so you understand that process, if you exert yourself that physically in anything, afterwards you get a generalized relaxation response, so you feel good. That's why running can make you feel good. It exhausts you so much you have to relax, and that's a trick you do. If you're tense and need to relax, a muscle can only be tense so long. So instead of saying to the muscle, relax, say to the muscle, get tense. And then it'll wear out and have to relax. And that, in part, is what was going on in Gestalt work. So we had people coming back and doing it over and over and over. But the very useful part of that work is resurfacing it. And so for some people it's important to beat on the pillow or scream at the wall or throw the plastic plate or the cheap glass plate because they need to identify, see, and visualize their anger, but you still need to deal with it. Just throwing it out isn't a cure. You have to reprocess it. But certainly repressed anger has always been one of the causes of depression. Other psychological or learning history?
Unresolved grief.
Unresolved grief, you bet. I told a story earlier about a friend of mine who went to his mother's funeral and didn't cry, and I asked him about that, and he said, well, it was my job to not cry. Somebody had to be strong. So I was strong for my wife, my brother, and my children, and so I didn't cry. Now he's processing that unresolved grief. He didn't make a choice out of selfishness. He absolutely thought he was doing the giving thing, but it wasn't, in reality, it wasn't a good thing for him or his family. Unresolved grief. Another one?
Loss.
You want to amplify that at all?
Loss, there's all kinds of loss, but I would say, depression could be maybe a multitude of them. Divorce, death, job status changes, some of the bigger losses, but even smaller ones.
And let's just take a minute with that, because I think there's two aspects to loss that contribute to depression, and sometimes we spot one and not the other. One aspect is what we lost, in terms of if it's security or companionship or a position. We've suffered the pain of whatever it is that we've lost, the burned down home, the divorce, the child with an illness or whatever. We have the what of the loss. There's another part of loss that often goes undetected, and it's what causes the real painful part of depression, and that's I'll just put SJ, that's self-judgment. And what goes in there is, I deserve, what was wrong with me that he or she left? What did I do wrong that God let my house burn down? Why wasn't, I remember another good friend of mine whose young girl died of cancer, and he went through an intense time of self-judgment. God took my girl because I wasn't a good enough Christian, and now I'll be a good enough Christian. So what happens in the loss process, or for a middle-aged or a little older man who gets in a company that merges and he loses his job and now he doesn't have that, he's lost his security, but what goes with it? Every morning, I'm not good enough, I'm not capable, I'm not smart enough, I'm not young enough. See, that self-judgment can eat us alive. And it's a hidden part of loss. And if we can deal with this in ourselves, we can usually deal with the what? It's the self-judgment that immobilizes us. And it's one of the reasons that for job relocation programs, you know how they do those in big cities when middle-aged people lose their jobs? They give them an office, you know, little cubicles lined up next to each other so they don't get isolated in dealing with relocation, because when you sit at home, you judge yourself so much and become so self-critical that you really get immobilized. And they found that the camaraderie of going in with 30 other unemployed people helps break down that self-judgment. Okay, any other aspects of our learning history or psychology that you would want to add here for causes of depression?
Vocational frustrations.
Vocational frustrations, sure.
Mm-hmm. Abusive situations.
Abuse, yeah. You know, childhood abuse, and the rule of thumb for childhood abuse is the earlier it is, the more damaging, and the longer it is, the more damaging, and the closer to your body it is, the more damaging. So emotional abuse is bad, and physical abuse is bad, and sexual abuse is the worst. And those things, the earlier and the younger and the longer, creates just devastating recurrent depressions in people. And it's literally like living with a cancer. And it gets hard for us, those of us who pretend that the brain isn't an organ and doesn't have a memory trail of all of this. And this is where your brain now and your psychology get tied together, because your brain has a computer trail of all of this stuff, whether you know it or not. And you find people operating on automatic pilot who come from abusive backgrounds, who are just saying to you, stay away, you're going to hurt me, I've got to test you. And then we do a good job, we stay away, we fail the test, and the person ends up very lonely and hurt. And so abuse, of course, is maybe one of the key causes for some of the most severe depressions. If I was going to pick two most predominant causes for most severe, not most, but the most severe types of depression, it would be abuse and it would be biochemical imbalance. Because some people just have a predisposition to a severe depressive illness that doesn't seem to come from anywhere in their world. Other people have been hurt so bad in their early years that just coming to terms with trusting themselves and others is almost a lifetime process. Okay, and then over here we have culture or environment. And what are some culture or environment causes of depression?
Being different
from others. Being different, not fitting in. Mm-hmm.
Living quarters?
Living quarters, yeah. Can you amplify that a bit?
Maybe a dark and dingy apartment?
Mm-hmm. Having a negative environment that you're in, mm-hmm. When you say darkness, it reminds me of one specific type of depression that the Oregon Health Sciences University researches because of being in a rainy climate, and that is seasonal affective disorder, and that's just a fancy name for a real small part of the population gets depressed when they're not exposed to enough sunlight. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us think we have that and we don't. Because a real small part of the population has that from a biochemical standpoint. For many of us, a dark day is an environmental cause of depression, not a biochemical. But for some people, it's actually the brain that needs more exposure to light. For most of us, it's our spirit that needs more exposure to light or a better environment. That's right. Mm-hmm. Other environmental causes.
Poverty and everything that goes with it.
Right. There's no doubt about that, poverty. And that's one of the causes of depression in young adolescents today and in poor cultures. And Ted Lalonde, who's one of the most well-known psychologists in the world, has identified poverty as a key cause of instability in adolescence. He doesn't get a lot of support from other clinicians because, you know, we can deal with these. It's real hard to deal with poverty. But he says that the key in poverty producing depression is the awareness of the poor person of affluence. That it was a lot better in the ghetto before the mall and before TV. And so he, believe it or not, he is really working and frustrated not so much with poverty, but with the availability of the image of affluence to poor people, because he believes it produces an intense instability in their personality. They constantly have this tension put in front of them. Very good point. Any others?
Changes in racism?
Sexism and racism?
Sexism and racism, sure. And those are cultural and environmental. And, what does it do? Do you want to amplify that for us, since you made the point about how it produces depression?
Well, from the standpoint of sexism, being in a culture that's predominantly run by males and being a female gives one a feeling of powerlessness and worthlessness.
Right.
And the same for racism.
Right. So you have the sense of powerlessness, which would be one of the diagnostic categories of depression. And that could come from any of these four things. See, biochemical imbalance creates the internal experience of powerlessness too. You just feel, I can't make a difference in my world. Not at all. But it's very different than if it comes from sexism. So this is where the careful evaluation of your depression or your family member's depression is so important. But that's exactly how it does. You work all your life and you get told no over and over and over again. Somebody else mentioned another.
Environmental changes such as moving or divorce or change in your what your normal situation would be.
Right.
What about the aging process?
They seem
more challenging.
That's really impressive. Tell us about that. Not in your life. In your parents' life. Or somebody else. How does that produce depression?
Inability to do things that you used to enjoy doing.
That's right.
Living in a youth culture too.
Yeah, you bet. And you know, that's a part of the problem for some folks and some cultures. Aging doesn't produce depression. It gives you more power and more respect and brings you more benefits. But clearly, in our culture, that's not the case. Okay. Well, is this making sense? This idea that depression, you know, the most common malady in mental health, is enormously complicated, multi-caused, and deserves a great deal of careful thought if you suffer from it or someone else does. And the idea of, you know, there's two things that I just don't believe in terms of depression, and one is pity. I don't believe it exists. You know, people come in, they say, oh, my wife said I'm having a pity party, or in Sunday school they said we were having a pity party. I don't see people having pity parties. I really don't. I mean, maybe you do. I think little kids do occasionally, maybe. But I'm very reluctant to see pain as self-pity. I'm very reluctant to see it that way. And I would encourage you to vote on the side of depression over self-pity, and you'll at least be right 9 out of 10 times. And if we vote this way, I think we'll be wrong the reverse number of times. And what you have to do is bring the right resources, enough time, and the right technique to whatever of these areas is producing the depression. Willpower has, the only place for willpower is getting you enough time and enough resources to deal with the appropriate area. You can't just snap out of it or make it better. And so these are two concepts I find very useless in dealing with depression. Now you can take me to task on that if you'd like. That's fine. Okay, well, let's stop. We've talked a lot about this. Take some questions and comments from your experience or your family or friends or your church experience. Any comments and questions you brought about depression?
Jim, up here again. I have a question. When you were talking about biological depression versus and medication and treatment versus counseling, you said that perhaps the administration of medication might have helped someone to recover quite quickly, maybe in 2 months, whatever. If they went the counseling route, it would take possibly a year. Is that because chemically their brain would have recovered and had been balanced? Or is that environmental, spiritual, cultural type things have been somewhat resolved so that the chemical imbalance wasn't quite as important as that one?
Let me answer your question by looking at point B on our outline under Roman numeral 1, which gives the symptoms of depression that are related more to your brain than to any other of these causes. And they are sleep disturbance, weight change, appetite change, decrease in concentration, and decreased sex drive, which isn't on here. Just listed, it's under other physical symptoms. Those areas would be areas that a mental health person would be cued in to understand as very related to brain process, because the brain controls your sleep. And so a severely depressed person will often have a variety of sleep disorders. I can't go to sleep, or I go to sleep and wake up. Or I go to sleep and wake up and fall asleep and wake up and do that all night. But sleep disorder, if you're or someone's experiencing, you know, sleep of only 4 or 5 hours a night, and some people have suffered with that for 3 or 4 years before they get help, you're really pushing your body to the limit. And I wouldn't see that as something that is going to be quickly responsive to counseling. Now, if in counseling you can reorganize your life fairly quickly, reduce the stress, increase good experiences and nurturing for yourself, then it might come around a little more quickly. But you're right in your question. There's no way to tell if you respond to counseling over the course of a year and the depression lifts, whether there was a biological component or not. But if you're a lay counselor or have friends, and you come across people with severe symptoms of sleep disturbance, weight change, lack of concentration, lack of sex drive, that's a time to think about the biological aspects of depression, the brain aspects.
In part B, we're asking the last thing, next to last line, blueness.
Mm-hmm.
What is that in relation to depression? How would it differ from?
Blueness is just the universal symptom of depression, and what's meant by that is that depression untreated can be a terminal illness, and we don't think of it that way. You probably don't hear people say that depression untreated is a terminal illness, but if you work with folks and see them die in a variety of ways, accidental, but you know, meaning that the person became much more accident prone. The highest suicide risk, the last time I looked at the statistics, were 60 to 65 year old men. women in our culture suicide gesture more than men, which is not, you know, some whiny plea for help. It's a very serious statement of, I need some help. But men don't do that, and older men don't. They tend to use lethal methods. And that's changing some. I know that's changing. But women tend to get into suicidal behavior with things like knives or pills, historically, and men do it with cars and guns. And so men end up succeeding more. And, you know, so we're talking about something that's enormously sad and serious when we look at someone who's let their depression go that long when there's available treatments for it. And men resist treatment more than women, because mental health treatment is for who? The weak. You know, when we talk about discrimination, certainly there's discrimination against women, there's discrimination against sex. The most typically discriminated variable in our culture, however, is weight. Overweight people are discriminated against more than any other particular group. And people with mental illnesses are discriminated against. And all you've got to do to notice that is see what happens to a politician who has ever been proved he was on a psychiatric medicine or in a psychiatric hospital. And even today, in Oregon and California, and I know this from firsthand conversations with judges, a good way for a woman to lose custody of her children is to have been in a psychiatric unit. And that, although we can say to people, there's no discrimination, it's a hospital, you need treatment, come ahead. In a divorce proceeding, if it comes out that a woman was in a psychiatric hospital, it can still go against her very, very severely. So there is that.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your phrase of mental health and mental illness. Mm-hmm. Why do you not use mental illness? Because that's what it is. Mental health implies maybe being able to help yourself, whereas mental illness suggests the biological.
Mm-hmm. I'm not using those very formally or technically, so I'm glad for you to refine that. You know, we just think of mental health professionals who treat mental illness.
But so often the community mental health can take many people, whereas mental illness is severe.
Right.
I have an impression that in your situation where you work, you have psychiatrists and psychologists and physicians that, so they can deal with all these areas, right? But that's not often the case.
Yeah, and in our clinic, we employ pastors, bona fide pastors, not pastoral counselors, preachers, if I can use that word. We have all three folks, and we assign the environmental task to be solved by one of the three, although sometimes we have a social worker.
I'm thinking in several cases where a person has gone to a psychiatrist and they have been given medication, and I know one in particular where there was a lot of abuse in this person's life, and the psychiatrist never even went to that. And I've also gotten the impression from things I've read that there's a lot of people that don't believe that any victimization in childhood is anything you need to deal with.
Yeah, a lot of people don't believe in PMS. Mm-hmm. But who are they?
But I mean, what I'm saying is, I guess we're real victims,
right,
of not knowing enough where to go and what to do when a problem like depression, particularly depression, because you're so depressed, you probably don't have everything around you. You don't have enough faculties to even look into things.
And that's why I made the comment about PMS, because when you're suffering and you go to a male physician who didn't used to believe in it, I think essentially believed in today, but it didn't used to mm-hmm. be. You didn't get much help, but you were so down you said, well, he must be right, and you went mm-hmm. away. Mm-hmm. But women became a little more aware of their own needs and started saying to people, you're wrong and we're right, please listen to us.
And one of the dangers in mental health is that you can land in any one of these groups and have your depression coming from another source, and they won't refer you. And that's why we have this time today, is so that you can be your own best advocate and the best advocate of your family members and friends. There's churches, very spiritual churches, that will only pray you out of your depression. There's churches all up and down the West Coast that if you go to a psychiatrist, psychologist, social worker, nurse practitioner, you'll be removed from eldership or teaching, or you'll be put on probation for a year, unless you can get your depression dealt with through the church's spiritual push-ups program. And it's not that their spiritual disciplines are wrong, they just don't apply to this problem. And so for you, they're very wrong. If that's the issue. Or you can end up taking medicine when the problem is childhood abuse. And who would tend to not believe in that? Someone who hadn't been hurt much as a child, someone who saw multiple personality disorder as a fictitious creation of psychotically ill men and women who were looking for an excuse for their confused life. But if you work with an awareness of the occult, and how much severe sexual predator abuse is going on in our culture when you see somebody who's that hurt, you know, you don't write it off as they made it up. You'll understand that abuse does that. So you have to be a good consumer. You have to know sometimes when to go see your pastor. To know, you know, this is about meaning in my life. This is about guilt. All the talking with my psychologist in the world isn't going to help, but I need to make peace with my God, however I understand God for me. So, good question. But you've got to be the one in charge of that sometime.
There was a case in California where a young boy had been diagnosed with a brain, you know, a problem where medication was helping him. Mm-hmm. And he was even mainstreamed into society, and then he got involved in a church, and the pastor said you shouldn't be taking these pills because you should be believe enough in God that you don't need this. So he went off the pills and he was babysitting somebody's children and he killed a 3-year-old child.
And speaking of biological cause, the statement that helped me the most in knowing I needed to take medicine is that if you suffer from a chemical imbalance, you need an antidepressant as a diabetic needs insulin. My doctor told me that. To me, that was a very helpful statement.
Good illustration. It's a good illustration. It's that real. And that's a nice illustration. And one of our jobs, you know, if you don't suffer from depression and your family members don't, I would enlist you today to join people in helping other folks make peace with taking antidepressant medication. I don't hide when I take an aspirin, and I don't think diabetics hide when they say, you know, I've got to eat a little cheese or run and take a shot. My friends don't anyway. But boy, you don't know very many people that bring their antidepressants to the dinner table.
There's another aspect of that too. It's not if it's biochemical, it's not necessarily an antidepressant that changes it. I know myself for the last about 6 months I've been on hormones because I've suffered from PMS all my life that I know of, and it's gotten worse as I've gotten older, and I finally went to one doctor that said there's no need for this, and he did a series of blood tests over one cycle and I started hormones and I feel entirely different, but it wasn't an antidepressant that was making it was just a hormone imbalance.
Right. And the hormones affect the brain pretty directly. So. Okay, other questions about this before we go on? Okay, I've just listed for you under two sort of a sequence of treatment for depression in general. And I don't want to belabor that, but usually we start with self-help. We ask ourselves what I can do differently, and if that works for a lot of us. Then we go to family and friends and find out what they've tried, and there we sometimes get support and sometimes pressure. Then we go to counseling, medication evaluation, medication, and hospitalization.
and people do need hospitalized, and I'm not here to sell that to you at all. But again, as we increase our awareness to be at peace with folks taking medicine or hormones or changing their lifestyle so they're not as stressed, it's also important to give people permission to go to the hospital. Because, you know, you do see a certain number of folks with depression die every year, and that's just enormously sad. And the hospital is sort of the last line of defense in psychiatric care. And it's a place a person can get medicine, a safe environment, a lot of counseling in a short period of time. But again, you need to be very good consumers, because psychiatric units are as different from each other as night and day, just like all other features of hospitalization. So select it with care, but help people not be afraid of it if they need it. And the community we find the most resistant to hospitalization who needs it are middle-aged Christian men. And the reason is that it's just seen as such a stigma, both to their masculinity, their age, and their faith. And it's really not uncommon to hear someone say, I'll die. You know, I will kill myself. I'll run that risk before I would ever suffer the humiliation of going into a hospital. Well, in the same office you hear a man talking about his bypass surgery coming up Monday, and they pass the card around, and they buy the flowers, and you know, it's no big deal. But to go to the hospital for this is somehow a major, major life failure. And just, we need to reverse that. And it's not reversed. It's very much in place as a stigma. Okay, outcomes of depression. What are the odds of getting better? They're really very good. Like I said earlier, 1/10 to 1/5 of the American population will suffer a severe depression sometime during their lifetime, between 6-month and 3-year period. The odds of getting better with the new treatments are very good. How long does it take? Our in-office studies are something like 90% of folks are significantly better and off of their medication in 1 to 2 years. Because as your life changes, you often don't need the same amount of medication. Are there ups and downs? And this is a part I put in here because we really need to understand this. Yes, if you have a vulnerability to ulcers, high blood pressure, pulling a certain muscle in your back, or any other illness, you will tend to have a vulnerability to a reoccurrence of symptoms in that area. And unfortunately, the same thing is true for depression. So, you know, if you get an ulcer and then get another one, we recently met a man, a businessman, who had, I think he was in for his 13th ulcer. But you know, that didn't have that much stigma attached to it because he was successful and his family loved him and everything was going fine. But if he had been readmitted for his 13th hospitalization for depression, how do you think his family would have felt? You know, this man's really, really got to get it together. How much can we put up with? These doctors don't know what they're doing. Science doesn't know what it's doing. And so I'm not at all saying that you're going to suffer over and over, or your friends are, but you need to have an awareness that we all tend to have reoccurrences of illnesses in specific areas. So we are going to struggle with it more than once.
And I'm thinking about the role that the insurance companies play in fueling the stigma, because if you have a recurrence from the same year, the insurance company will not cover you. And so you have to select your depression carefully.
I've seen several folks around here who are in healthcare. I think if we did a forum on health insurance, the whole village would be It's just enormously complicated. Insurance is a business. Healthcare is not supposed to be patient by patient. It often is, you know that. Insurance and healthcare often are really at odds in some of these issues, but you're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll hear another point about that experience is that often if you belong to an HMO, they'll send you to a social worker, and if your doctor does not refer you to a psychologist, psychiatrist, whatever, you're either on your own or you stay with a social worker, whether they can help you or not.
And social workers are essentially very well-trained folks.
Right.
The issue, and I was talking about this privately with some folks, if you go to an orthopedic surgeon, essentially they know the same body of information, essentially, one to another. Or if you go to a pediatrician, essentially they share the same body of knowledge in common. In mental health, that is not the case at all, at all. And so you aren't going to professionals that are interchangeable. Psychiatrists don't interchange with psychiatrists. There's just so much to know. There's knowing about kids and older age and abuse. And you have to, again, then be a really good consumer and find someone who can help you, who knows about your area of problem. Very important.
Could I add to that? In Washington State there, we have something called the Washington Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And they have, in the last 4 years, been compiling a file on doctors and psychiatrists. And so if you're in the state of Washington and should need to access information about that, they will give you a rundown on the types of psychiatrists and doctors around, and medical doctors as well, who are related to this field, and they will say, well, you know, this has been the experience with this guy, and this woman tends to do this, and so, you know, watch for that. And they're very, very helpful that way. They have a number in Seattle as well as other areas of the state.
That's a question, how to go shopping. How do you go shopping?
Exactly. It's very expensive to shop it on yourself.
Yes, it's very expensive.
Well, one of the ways you shop is by understanding this. Mm-hmm. And you begin to understand yourself, and you begin to think about your own life and your own situation. Not that we can treat ourselves, because I think, in a sense, counseling and mental health is a little bit like an attorney, you know. You don't want to be your own client because you can't see the things you need to see. But this awareness can really help, can help you in your shopping.
Well, there's a point at which, you know, I know there are many people who can't afford to make a conscious decision to go out and spend money for counseling help if they don't have insurance that covers it. But on the other hand, I wouldn't let my foot bleed until I die. And so, you know, there may be some priorities that we have to take to make sure they have a healthy mind and emotional well-being.
This is where the more ill a person is, the more you would want a team approach in working with them or yourself, for efficiency's sake and for cover these bases. But you're right, we don't let ourselves, we know to go to an emergency room if we're bleeding, and we don't think about the price. The trouble with, and this is the real sadness, this is the real pain, and I think some of you understand this, that in mental health people don't always get well. And that's a side we haven't talked a lot about today, and it's not something I want to emphasize, because there's really good hope. But for some folks, there's only care, there's not cure. And again, as a Christian community, that's where we need to see ourselves as having a unique role. Being willing to care for people and to care about relationships where there isn't going to be a cure. And we just know that for all illnesses, there's folks who don't recover. And that's true as well with more serious forms of mental illness. And we need to then not discard that person from our world or our church.
Would that cover schizophrenia?
That could apply maybe even more directly to schizophrenics than some form of depression. Although with the right medication and the right amount of stress management, because one of the very difficult things for chronic schizophrenics is that that they tend to try to manage more than they can, and then they have a recurrence of their illness. But with the right amount of stress management and the right medication, many, many of these folks can live very comfortably and dignified lives in our midst. But if we keep trying to make them well, because we know that for a certain type of schizophrenic person, every time they try to get a job, they get sick again. Well, what happens is we just aren't at peace with them being disabled. And so we get them on their medicine and they look good, and we push them out into the workplace, and we know they failed and they continue to fail. So it has to do, again, with a careful evaluation of all four of these areas for ourselves, our friends, and I think we'll live better with each other. Any final comment or question before we need to end today?
I'm troubled by the fact that there's a large segment of our population that doesn't have the luxury of being able to do this. People who are uninsured, people who don't have the money. I have a friend who needs help very badly, and there's just no money. It's very hopeless.
I'm equally troubled. We started our own Lopi clinic just for that reason, but it's enormously sad. Yeah.
I really want to thank you for emphasizing the severe, the genuine severity of depression, because I think for those who have not suffered depression, it does become a matter of willpower. And that is a very unfortunate kind of judgment that we then apply to a person who is desperately ill. And it's like crying. I'm uncomfortable with an adult crying, so I said, don't do that. Feel good and stop crying. And we brush depression off in the same way. But you just make up your mind to get over it.
Yeah, just snap out of it. When you said that was, oh yeah. Heard that before.
That's the one step.
Right.
The one
follow Nike's ads, you know what that one-step program is. Just do it. And it's like you'd never thought of that on your own.
What can family members do to help then?
Well, I think the first thing you can do is realize just how tough it is for that person who can't get out of bed. But it has nothing to do with their willpower. But they just literally feel that bad. And if they'd been vomiting all night, we'd be running in with cold towels and hot tea. And then I think we can begin to look for resources and not give up. Insist that people go to county mental health. Flood your county mental health with patients. In most states, it's the law they have to take care of them. But we get good at going away when we get rebuffed. I have ladies in my church that will come get clients who need county mental health and take them. And so they have a witness. And those folks get help when the county says they're full. You know, people need help. Just like if you had a friend who had a broken leg, we would know what to do as a community. Use the same type of intervention. But remember, it's not all going to happen in the medical community. The church needs to have a role in the treatment of depression as well. Preachers and lay ministers need to be working with folks, and the whole area of lay counseling and so on. Well, thank you very much. We need to end for a while.